So my name's Trish Byrne. I'm one of the nurses here, proud employees of the Community Health Center, the building that you're all at this evening. So thank you for coming in, and hopefully you take a minute on your way out and check out our board of all our events and programming that we have, because it's a really great place. And we're really excited to partner with Northumberland Hills Hospital on the PACE initiative. So for those of you that come to these regularly, you'll know that we offer host the PACE talks every other time. So next time we'll be back at the hospital, but tonight we're here. So just a brief background a little bit about what the PACE talks are and why we're doing them for some of the newcomers tonight. PACE stands for Personalized Assessment Change Education. And they're actually inspired by the ever so popular TED Talks, for those of you that have gone online and been entertained by those. And it's really there to promote the self-education and the self-learning aspect of being healthy. The initiative came to light with Dr. Mukesh Bhargava, who can't join us tonight. He's engaged in something else, but you'll see him next month back at the Northumberland Hills Hospital. And through that, he's partnered with the Northumberland Family Health Team, the Community Health Centers of Northumberland, also known as us, and the other group of internal medicine specialists that function out of Northumberland Hills Hospital's caregivers, and I think probably the most important group of people at the planning table for these events and the topics for future discussion ideas are the patients or the people like yourselves in the community and the clients that are here listening and gathering the information. So welcome to tonight's event, and thank you. I would proud to introduce our guest tonight, our guest speaker, Paul Burnham, and he's accompanied by his silent partner, I've been informed over here, Ann Burnham. So we're here tonight talking, exploring the topic of farm-to-table eating. So great topic, excited to hear all about this. A brief history. I'm going to let Paul do the majority of his introduction, because he'll obviously do it a little better than I can do. But when I was looking to see what could I say about Paul, I looked online and I was looking at the write-up that the Northumberland Hills Hospital website does a really great job. And this paragraph stuck out to me because I thought it's impressive. So together with his wife Anne, Paul's purchased the land that they currently have their market on, 1994. And the two are now in their 25th year of producing fruits and vegetables. Today they operate as a multi-generational farm, with three of their four children heavily involved in the business. Mark on the farming side and Kate and Amy with running the market. And then Paul informed me that they've actually had the home farm since the 1800s. Yeah, way back in the day. And on a personal flair, Paul informed me that he has interests in both hockey and theater. And he wasn't giving me any other dirty details that I could share with you, so that's as good as we could get. But anyways, welcome, Paul, and looking forward to hearing your talk.
Thank you. So you guys are really close. And there's no thing to put my papers on, so I'll be holding the papers. Hopefully I won't read word for word, but I kind of have to keep with the script, because Anne's got to click at the appropriate spots, and she has a copy of this. So again, thank you to Northumberland Hills Hospital Foundation for the invitation to speak with everyone today. How is everybody today?
Great.
So everybody had supper yet? You're in a good mood? No. Okay, well, we'll be quick then.
What time is closing time?
Yeah. So my name's Paul Burnham. By way of introduction, I'll repeat a little bit that was already told to you. Our family runs two farming operations right now, the first being the market that you heard about, and we've owned and operated since 1994, and the second operation is our cash crop operation, which my son Mark and I run. We grow almost 2,000 acres of cash crops. A lot of that land is rented. We grow corn, soybeans, wheat, hay, and edible beans. The market's run by Ann, Kate, Amy, and myself, and the cash crop operation is run by Mark and myself. And, of course, there's employees at the market, and we have one full-time employee helping us with the cash crop operation. My daughter, Jen, she's our oldest, and she runs Maplewood Stables. If you go from Cobourg to Port Hope, you'll see a lot of horses on the north side just around our place, and that's her horse boarding operation. She has about 50 horses. A lot of them are boarded, and she also gives lessons. And that's the original homestead. That's where I grew up, and that's the farm that's been in the family for so long. So today I've been asked to talk about farm-to-table eating. I've also been asked, I've talked a lot about growing things and farming and what we do and here and there, but this one's a little different because I've been asked to relate this to health. And as this talk, after all, is being sponsored by so many healthcare agencies in this area. This topic allows us to explore how buying and consuming local produce affects things like your physical health, obviously for nutrition, and mental well-being, which is kind of what I'm going to go into a little later on. The local economy, global warming, community building, and supporting sustainable farming practices. So when we're done, I'm going to let you all go for supper. I want you to all feel good about the choices you make when you purchase the food. So let's start out with defining what farm-to-table eating is. Quite simply, it is the buying and preparing of food that is locally grown. That's a no-brainer. But everybody has a different idea of what is local, but for the purposes of this talk, we're going to assume that local is Ontario. A little bit of history. Let's go way back to Ontario's pioneers and our ancestors, because when they came over from wherever they came from, they had little options. They came to a new land. If they're lucky, they had a cow and a horse or an oxen, a few hand tools, and the pluck to start a new life in the new world. So once they arrived, they had to find a piece of land, clear it for growing crops, and build a shelter to survive what to some would be their first taste of a good Canadian winter. So their diet would consist of wild game, any fresh vegetables that they could produce that first year, and of course they grew root crops for the winter, like potatoes, turnip, and carrots. The wheat flour, of course, a big staple back then was bread, and their wheat flour was made from their own wheat. If they were lucky enough to plant and harvest a crop that first year, and sugar was a luxury for the better-off settlers, although sugar beets at some point were grown and processed in this area as well. An interesting note is that the Port Hope Agricultural Society this year celebrated 225 years from the first wheat harvest. And that's a long time, because that puts us back in the late 1700s. So we've been growing wheat in the area for that long. So as you can see, the settlers back then had very much a farm-to-table lifestyle. Seasonality was a big factor, so diets changed with the progression of the seasons. So these original settlers, they put some years behind them, and their farms expanded. Now they had a little bit of experience under their belts. Livestock became part of their operation. So milk, beef, pork, and chickens entered the mix. And I'm just going to tell you, and of course, Anne's the historian in the family. If you know anything about Mother Burnham, talk to her, don't talk to me. But anyway, she had this little excerpt from a book called The Pioneer Farmer and Backwoodsman, and in it, it had something about my ancestors. So I'm just going to read you a paragraph here about it to show you how difficult it was. Initiative and enterprise characterized many a pioneer. It is recorded of Zacchaeus Burnham, who chopped himself out a clearing near Cobourg, just as the 18th century was drawing to a close, so he almost cut a foot off the first winter. And that he lost his stock not once but several times, but persevering undaunted by difficulties, he had eventually a fine 600-acre farm adjoining the courthouse to the northwest of the village, so that would be right near Cobourg. To raise a flock of sheep and collect a few cattle, we are told, was a labor of many years. After several years' labor and privations, Mr. Burnham succeeded in purchasing two ewes. These were either lost or destroyed. Then he traveled at least 100 miles and brought home two more. One of these died, and the other lived to produce lambs, but these were also destroyed by the pigs. So it wasn't all the coyotes and the bears. The pigs actually ate them. At last, he managed to purchase half a dozen sheep, and part of these he lost also. At length, he had raised enough wheat to buy a cow and a yoke of oxen, and from this time, he began to prosper. So very much a learning experience, and a lot of us here, when we were farming in our family, some of that experience has been passed on to us, so we don't have to suffer all those losses that they did back then. But anyway, as time went by, farmers started to specialize. Livestock farmers did not necessarily grow their vegetables. They opting to buy these with the money they gained from selling some of their livestock and some of their milk. Grain farmers also found their niche and sold their first crop to the grist mills for flour making and cattle feed. Tradespeople such as farriers, carpenters, and town businessmen with no farms found more and more variety at local markets as local farmers started to produce more food. As you can see, general farming was on the way out, and specialized or commodity farming was gaining a foothold. So let's fast forward to today, and we see this trend more and more defined. We have cash croppers, dairy farmers, beef farmers, pig producers, egg producers, apple growers, and the list goes on. More and more specialization. This is not a bad thing, it's just different. And then as our transportation system, planes, trains, and ships, and trucks became more reliable and economical, the choices for the consumer widened so that now, as you all know, we can have every type, variety, color, and flavor of all our favorite foods pretty much every day of the year. So local eating local can mean buying from local farm markets such as ours, local farmers markets, which bring together producers from around the county, or gardening yourself, eating from your own backyard. So why buy local? Our grocery supermarkets have everything we need. This is a huge question, and the buy local movement has been a huge trend for the last 15 to 20 years. Well, let's start with the local economy. Dollars spent locally tend to circulate in the local community. The more money spent locally, the more local businesses prosper, and the government collects taxes to keep your municipality going. The story is asked of a farmer who had just won the lottery. Somebody said, "What are you going to do with all that money?" Well, he said, "That's simple. I'll just keep farming until it's all gone." That's a little simplistic, but somewhat true. Just ask Mark, my son. But but it's true. The money earned at the farm is soon spent in the community on hardware, building materials, and maybe even the odd night out. Summers are busy times at these markets, and many jobs are created, and students have the potential to work at a lot of these local farms. Well, you're almost there. There we go. There's Hannah. So the second one, global warming. We all hear about talk about sustainability. Buying that cabbage or basket of beans from a local producer means that we have to import less food from California, Mexico, South America, or Asia, China specifically. Food grown from that far away requires a huge amount of fuel for transportation, as you all know. So the carbon footprint for that bundle of grapes, even though we buy them ourselves, is huge. Less emissions, so the carbon footprint for local food, on the other hand, is much smaller. The less emissions into the air, less diesel trucks down the road means cleaner breathing. So another option that local markets have is the opportunity to use less packaging. I know one thing we are working at our market is the use of fewer plastic bags, and we're working at it. I was asked about this tonight, in fact, about some of our bags. But we're working on that. More and more people bring in totes and carry out their own groceries.
I've got one question. You've got the plastic.
Yep. Clamshells?
Yeah. Are they recyclable?
Yes, they are. You just have to wash them and put them in the blue bin. Hopefully they'll make their way to the recycling plant. Another lesser-known advantage of small markets is that there's less food waste. I know at our place, we make soups, we make stir fries. This is all from vegetables that are starting to go south, as the saying goes. Whereas I know a lot of supermarkets reach the best before date and it's gone, and they throw it in the dumpster behind. So using this food waste again puts less strains on our landfills, and any produce that is beyond making those things, we just take it out to our fields and dump it as compost. So. Another thing is food safety. Food produced in Canada, and specifically Ontario, is grown with practices that have been reviewed and regulated by our own governments. Canada has some of the most stringent protocols in the world when it comes to standards for irrigation water, pesticide application, and harvesting and storage of food crops. The food you buy from Canadian farmers is very safe. So let's go to nutrition and freshness. These two are related, and I believe that at optimum ripeness and freshness, produce is also at its peak nutrition and tastes the best. I think a lot of you would agree with that. Food grown offshore from Florida or California is harvested before it is ripe, and there's good reason for that. They have to pick produce, let's say California, for instance. They have to pick something there, throw it in a truck, And then that truck's got to bounce across North America to Coburg, and by the time it gets here, it still has to look nice and firm and fresh. Like, I know if I did that with my strawberries, they'd be strawberry jam by the time they got anywhere else, because we pick them when it's ripe. So picking green, as I'll call it, means that the final ripening has not occurred yet, and the total nutrient package hasn't yet arrived at that edible part of the plant. So the longer you leave the fruit or the vegetable on the vine, the more nutrients can go into that. So the closer the market is grown, or the closer the product is grown to the market, the closer to ideal ripeness it can be picked. Like I said, we can pick product that is ripe and put it on the shelves immediately. An example close to home is Ontario peaches grown in Niagara. The reason Niagara is so successful growing that kind of thing is they tend not to have the extreme cold temperatures that we do. Peaches are picked when they're green so that they can survive the trek by truck to markets across Ontario. Don't get me wrong, once the peaches ripen at home, they're delicious. So I decided a few years ago to try to plant some. So we have planted about 45 peach trees on our farm. Josh, did you plant those? Yeah. Josh used to work for us. I remember he was planting some of those. So temperatures, the trouble with peaches is you get temperatures hovering around minus 20 degrees. It can freeze the buds and it'll produce peaches that will produce peaches the following summer. So you can imagine our cold winters, often the buds are no good. So as a result, my planting was a bit of a gamble, and we've only had two real good harvests from these trees in the last 10 to 12 years because of the cold winters. But this is what they looked like when we picked them. When we did harvest our own peaches, it's quite a difference. The fruit was surprisingly large. Some of it was bigger than the stuff you get from Niagara. And when they are allowed to ripen on the tree, they are very juicy and have that full peachy flavor. When you pick them off a tree, they don't need to be peeled. You just grab one, chomp down on them, and wait for the juice to run down your arm. That's such a pleasure to go that first year we had them, just pick them and eat them. And wow, I said, this is really neat. I'm sure some of you did anybody here buy any that we grew ourselves? We have a few hands going up. But we had very limited amounts, so as soon as we picked them and put them on the shelf, they were gone in no time. So this serves as an intro to another benefit to local eating. It's your sense, hopefully, of well-being and satisfaction, and that comes into your mental health. And this is the health part I said I was going to bring into the talk. Can eating local benefit your state of mind? I would like to say yes. See all these people smiling? I think if you're happy, I think it's healthy, right? We're all your nurses around here. You can probably attest to that. So food is life. We can't avoid it. We need to eat. So we should try and embrace it and enjoy it heartily. How do we turn the whole shopping, preparing, eating experience into a joyful one? So research indicates that one of the top reasons people prefer to buy from local producers is the trust aspect. Local farm markets allow the consumer to make connections with the farmer so that they can get a feeling of how their food is grown. And we experience that at our own place. Most owners of local markets gladly enter discussions about how their produce is grown. I would like to think that after talking with a customer and addressing some of their concerns or ideas, I leave them with a better feeling about their food choices. Have I ever talked to you guys, anybody here, about certain things? Okay. So hopefully you're more content and happier when they prepare your meals after I talk to you. And this has to be good for your well-being, feeling good about the product you've just bought and preparing it and eating it. Perhaps some stress relief, perhaps a tiny bit of joy entering your souls. I see this also at farmers' markets. Most towns have one of these where farmers come from across the county and congregate to sell their bounty. Recently, the Coburg Farmers Market moved to the Rotary Park location. It's a pretty wide open space with lots of room for kids to run around while their parents shop for the food. So the place is buzzing, literally buzzing on the Saturday morning. Right, Stacy? Where'd Stacy go?
Yes, that is correct.
See, I have people planted in the audience for these. People are chatting with their neighbors, with the farmers that produce the food, and with fellow customers, talking about what they bought or the bargain they had. Five stalls down, go over there and buy those things, yeah. It's exciting and fun. When I go to if I have to, I don't stay much time there. My daughter runs the booth, but if I have to come in the middle of the morning to deliver more stuff, it's a pretty neat feeling. Again, it's a pleasant experience centered around the purchase of dinner. This is a great example of community health. There we come with the health again. Communication and relationship building. Imagine if we could transplant that atmosphere to our whole town or neighborhood, how much more pleasant it would be. So another source of local eating, besides the farm markets and the farmers markets, two different things, is your garden. Could be your backyard. How many of you here garden? Vegetable gardens. They used to, or you used to, yeah. So I hope for most of you, this is also a mind-clearing, positive experience. Once you get past the weeding, the bug squishing, and the watering. So sometimes I can work that computer, and that was pretty neat when I found that one. There's nothing quite like growing your own vegetables and enjoying the first taste of freshness from your own efforts. Not only nutritionally great, but again, that sense of self-accomplishment can relieve a lot of stress. I'm going to have a drink of water. That's a really tough bug.
Protein get baked into.
Well, that's possible. I want also to share with you how eating local is beneficial to the local producer. Let's call this farmer health. People buying from local farmers not only help them financially, thank you very much, but mentally or psychologically as well. So let's explore this one. A lot of what Mark and I grow on the large acreage is defined as grain or oil seeds. The field corn we grow is shipped to ethanol plants to make the ethanol addition for gasoline. The soybeans go to crushing plants where the oil is extracted and refined into cooking oil. I think Crisco is made of soybean oil. The wheat goes to flour mills. The edible beans go to central warehouses where they are cleaned, packaged, and shipped to markets across the world. There is great satisfaction in growing a high-quality, high-yielding crop. It's fun to do that. This year we tried azuki beans for the first time and had good luck on our first go-round, so now we're going to grow more of them. Hopefully next year they'll be just as good. Azuki beans. Azuki. So it's a small reddish-brown bean that is shipped to Japan, and they grind it down into a powder, and then they make a paste out of it. You know about azuki beans? Yeah? Okay. You got some recipes?
I have to know these things.
What's that?
I'm a dietitian. I have to know these
things. There you go. So anyway, we grow them, and we're going to grow more next year. But as you can see, there's not growing these large fields. There's not a lot of social interaction. There's not 1,000 people running around that elevator that we can talk to and all about how great that azuki crop was. Not a lot of social interaction with the end user, the person buying the flour, person putting the ethanol. Okay. Person putting the ethanol blend of gasoline in the car. I don't go to the gas station and say, how do you like that ethanol? You know, it's kind of nothing. When we sell directly to the consumer, we get a lot of instant feedback. People tell us about how well they like their sweet corn or our strawberries or our apples. To us, this is very verification that what we do is valuable, that we are appreciated. It keeps us going. Not only do we have the experience and mostly pleasurable feeling of growing the food ourselves, we get positive vibes from you. And that is real nice after a long day in the field. Positive feedback and even constructive criticism helps us in many ways. And some of that feedback affects what we will grow next year and how we will grow it. People tell us perhaps what apples they prefer, the sweet corn that tasted the best, and as a producer, I've been influenced by you. We are growing more and different produce. We are careful with how we control pests and recognize the real and highly emotional reactions associated with crop inputs. It's a win-win for us all. You get to feel good about buying from someone you trust, hopefully you trust me, and I get confidence that what I'm doing is what the customer, you, wants. Another plus on my side is the opportunity to share with you a lot of current discoveries and food facts. Farmers have access to a ton of information on food production. Any week we receive in the mail seven to eight publications on topics ranging from political issues on world food production to how to keep your family involved on the farm. safety issues, health issues, community issues, global issues, it's all there. And that doesn't even touch the internet. The internet can be a great source of information and knowledge, as you all know. Unfortunately, it can also contain false and misleading articles based on opinions and poorly researched facts. It has the ability, see, this was the latest thing. Have you seen this on the internet? Somebody crossed a shark with a horse. And anyway, all those articles have to be viewed with critical minds. I see part of my role as a farmer to be able to literally sort the grain from the chaff, the good stuff from the misinformation based on my own experience and science-based facts. Another thing that I and other farmers can benefit from when selling locally is a sense of future. If I can see value in my business, I want to see it continue. And one way to do that is for my kids to keep it going. Positive feedback translates to positive talk around the dinner table. Now, I'm not saying all talks around the dinner table are great, because we've had some very tense moments and heated discussions. But mostly, I mean, we're still at it, so something must be coming out of those talks. When the next generation sees that mom and dad are happy and excited about growing and marketing product from the fields, it can rub off. Suddenly, the succession plan is coming together. Not having to worry about selling the farm somewhere down the line takes a load off our minds. In our case, we know the farm will be in good hands once Ann and I are no longer involved. It has been a lifelong passion of mine to stop the loss of good agricultural land to urban development. Once the land is under houses, it is gone for agriculture permanently. And as Mark Twain once said about land, they aren't making any more of it. Keeping the next generation involved is the best way to keep the land in farming. And I must say, our kids have taken this to heart and seem poised to continue. Because local farm markets and farmers markets are very seasonal, the grocery supermarket has a niche in all our lives. Delivers everything from soup to nuts, and small country markets usually don't try and compete with the complexity of products found there. Some of the big chains try to buy from local producers, but are sometimes limited by their parent companies committed to large central warehouses, supplying everything year-round. Local producers are seasonal, local producers like us are seasonal, and our inconsistencies do not necessarily lend themselves to supply to the big chains. So in the past, we have sold to Metro and places like that, but because our supplies are inconsistent, they say, oh, I got to go to my warehouse because I know I can get it every day, day after day. So quite often, there are some local products in the local supermarkets, but you have to look for them. Smaller farm markets harken back to a day when families ate according to the seasons. And I think a lot of us here can remember some of the times when produce shelves were just a little bit barer than they are today. So let's talk about eating in season. As I mentioned before, our ancestors had no choice. With no electricity, refrigeration was not an option or a very limited option. So after a long cold winter, spring veggies such as asparagus, peas, and lettuce greens were among the first fresh treats to arrive. Strawberries, raspberries, and green beans came next. The middle of the summer brought on a whole variety of food, radishes, cauliflower, cucumbers, and all the root vegetables. Gardens flourished, and variety was indeed the spice of life. Every few weeks, something new was available, so as the season progressed, you could look forward to something. Can you imagine all the anticipation, the excitement buildup? Very good for your brain, I would say. As fall approached, potatoes, turnips, yams, carrots were picked and pickled and preserved. This would be the winter stash. Variety came in the form of how a certain veggie was preserved. The root cellar was full. Meat was salted and smoked. Diets changed, and so the cycle went. As refrigeration arrived, a lot of families picked or purchased produce in season, and froze a huge amount in their 24 cubic foot freezers. Can you remember the big freezers everybody used to have? I can remember a youngster, and don't flick it, because I forgot to put this slide in, but we have a really good picture of myself and a couple of my siblings sitting around outside husking corn with my grandfather, because we used to, first of all, peas were the first thing. We had to go pick peas. And we picked like two or three bushels of peas, and then we'd have to hand shell them. And then Mom would blanch them and cool them and bag them, and it was great in the middle of winter when you're eating them, but yeah, that wasn't a whole lot of fun. Then we'd do beans. We'd have to cut all the beans up and freeze and blanch them and freeze them. And then came sweet corn, and we used to pick bags, probably 60 to 100 dozen corn. And the picture had we were husking corn, throwing the husks in the pile. That was a little more pleasurable than the other two, but you could see progress because the corn was so big. And then we had, of course, in the house, we had a basement with one room dedicated to potatoes. So we have this big pile of potatoes in the middle of the room. We put it on bed springs in case the potato, in case the cellar flooded, so the potatoes were off the floor. So this big pile of potatoes that we'd go down every few days, and we called it the dungeon. And we'd pick a few potatoes out and bring them upstairs. Well, by the time spring came along, the potatoes had eyes on them, 3 feet long. And the actual potato itself was pretty mushy, but when you peeled it and boiled it, it still tasted like a potato, and it's still good. So can and should we go back to that? Well, we definitely can if we wanted to, but I don't think there's any should. It's all up to your personal choices. Dietitians still stick to multiple servings of fruit and vegetables, right? Yes. Thank you. Balanced with the protein supplied by beans, meats, and milk products. If we still want to eat local during the non-growing seasons, we can freeze and preserve produce that was grown in the area. So there we have it. Buying and eating local can stimulate the local economy, lower our carbon footprint, and promote sustainable farming practices. It can also lead to healthier eating and relieve some mental stress from our lives. Our community health also prospers with interactions at local markets, and farmers who receive direct feedback are healthier and happier for it. One of my high school teachers used to say, as we came into class, sit back, relax, we're going to have a test. So we could change that to sit back, relax, enjoy your supper. For the moment, life is good. That's it.
Thank you so much, Paul. That was excellent. I appreciate it. Everybody in the room knows where you can find Ann and Paul and Burnham's wonderful market and tasty biscuits and wonderful muffins and all the other good stuff there. But County Road 2, so when are you open until? When?
The 23rd.
The 23rd.
Of December.
Okay, so the clock's ticking, so head out there. But thank you so much. And thank you for everyone for coming. These events obviously wouldn't happen if it wasn't for the people attending, so we appreciate that. Thanks to Loyalist, who's recording and taping the show, and I don't know how long does it usually take? I don't know. Yeah, well, it'll be online at some point. Up next month, Don't Be a Vector, how to Prevent Spreading Infections and Getting Them with Dr. Daniel, I don't know if I'm saying this right, but Rizzuto, and that will be at Northumberland Hills Hospital. So that pre-registration, as you know, is required. So you can just go online. It's free, but registration is required. Okay, well, thank you. Have a great night. Safe drive home. Thank you so much.